I was already planning to do this, but in light of what Doug said, it seems maybe especially appropriate. I will tell you, Jeremy called me, was it a month and a half ago, something like that, and he said, would you be interested in teaching at the men's day? And I'm very interested, yeah. We'd like you to teach on anger. And I don't think Jeremy was expecting the response he got from me. I started laughing, and I wasn't laughing humorously. I will confess to you, brothers, I have had a problem with anger, and it really started peaking here recently. And not violent or anything like that, but I'm loud already, and I've struggled with it. Sometimes not struggled with it, and let it have a foothold in my life. And this study has done for me exactly what Doug was talking about. It's revolutionized my life in that regard. It's only been a short time. I hope to see that continue, and I have confidence with the Lord's help it will. But it has helped because the fact of the matter is, although I've talked about anger cursorily here and there for years, I had never, until I prepared for this, really gotten down into the nitty-gritty to see what God really says about it. And once I did that, it changed me. Because, at least for the moment, I am wrapped. Because I've been thinking about it for days on end. And it's awful hard to live with yourself doing something you know is so terribly wrong. The Bible introduces us to questions very early on. The very first question we have in the Bible, Genesis chapter 3, verse 1, we have Satan asking Eve, has God really said you can't eat of every tree of the garden? And then because of the fact she and Adam sinned, we have God walking through the garden in the cool of the day. Adam and Eve are hidden. And God, either He chose not to know or He knew. We all ask teaching questions. He asks the second question in the Bible, which is, where are you? They're lost. But then the third question of the Bible, in chapter 4, Cain sees that God accepts his brother's offering, but he doesn't accept his. Cain becomes very angry. And in Genesis chapter 4, verse 6, God comes to Cain, and what's He ask him? Why are you angry? Why are you angry? And from that point on, the Bible talks about anger. I don't know if it's in every book. It might be. I didn't take a look at that. Probably not in every single book. But there are at least 550 verses in the Bible that mention anger explicitly. Anger, fury, rage, wrath, some version of... That's not counting all the times it's being discussed without the word being used. For example, when David decides he's going to kill Nabal over in 1 Samuel chapter 25. It's clear David's angry, although the word's not used. But 550 verses at least mention anger, some version of it outright. And I don't want to be laborious here, but I feel like this illustrates the point well. Hang with me for just a moment while I list to you, this won't be exhaustive, but it's close, of all the individuals in the Bible who are explicitly said to be angry. God, of course, He's angry with the wicked every day, Psalm 7:11. Cain, Esau, Jacob, Jacob's sons, and later special emphasis on Simeon and Levi, Potiphar, Pharaoh, and many of these, by the way, are said to be angry multiple times. Pharaoh, Moses, Balaam, Balak, the men of Ephraim, Zebul, the ruler of Shechem, Judges 9, if that doesn't ring a bell. Samson, Saul, Eliab, David's oldest brother, Jonathan, the princes of the Philistines, Abner, the men of Israel, David, Naaman, the troops of Israel, Asa, Uzziah, Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites, Nehemiah, Ahasuerus, Haman, the Shulamite's brothers. Remember the woman there in Song of Solomon? She talks about how her brothers got angry in Song of Solomon 1:6. Rezin, king of Syria, Moab, Sennacherib, Nebuchadnezzar, the Greek nation, Jonah, Herod the Great, those in the Nazareth synagogue when Jesus preached there for the first time, Jesus, the people in Jerusalem, the Sanhedrin, Herod Agrippa, the Ephesian mob in Acts 19, Paul, and Satan. 51 individuals and groups whom the Bible specifically says were angry. And that's close to exhaustive. It's not totally exhaustive. Now, if I take out the groups, the handful of nations that were mentioned, I take all the nations out, and I take out the people of the city and the people of Nazareth, I take all those out, and I'm just left with straight individuals, did you notice a theme? What did every single individual have in common? They're all male. Every single one of them. In fact, there is no instance in the whole Bible where a woman is specifically named who is angry. Now, when Michal saw David out there jumping around and showing himself in a way that she thought was inappropriate, it says she despised him. She was probably angry at him, but she's not said to be. But there is no woman who is explicitly said in the Bible to be angry. We do have an example of a type of woman, Proverbs 21:19, better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. But that's the only time. Well, the Bible's a patriarchal book, John. Yeah, but to that extent? I don't think so. So what's the Bible telling us? Well, something you probably knew already. I mean, I don't have the experience that some of you in this room do, but I've had the opportunity to meet with a number of people, couples, and invariably, when there's marital problems, almost always, who's the more selfish of the two? The husband. If there is an anger problem, almost always, who is it? It's the husband. So this is very relevant to you and me. Men, by far, have more of a problem with this. And it's relevant also because in our day and age, there's lots of anger. We are affected by what we're encountering. I mean, ours is the era of road rage. We got people spewing anger off the radio, off the television, in modern music, and our political figures. They're all spouting anger. So, let's talk about it, what the Bible tells us about it. And I am going to try to be very careful not to bore you with a bunch of unnecessary information, but there are three Greek words which I think will be useful to us. One of the things that kept me from digging into this topic, it wasn't because I was afraid of what I would learn, but I knew that the translators had not done a very good job of accurately representing in the English what was going on in the Greek, and I admittedly kind of dreaded to get in there and have to go through all the weeds. But I finally did it, and I'm glad I did. There are three nouns translated anger or wrath in the New Testament, and they are not synonyms. Once in a while there's some overlap, but they are distinct words. The first one is this word right here, thumos. The emphasis is on the second syllable, thumos. And this word appears 18 times in the New Testament. 18 times. 15 of the 18 times it is translated wrath in the King James, either in the singular or plural. So 15 of its 18 appearances is translated wrath. Now, if I go to Bauer-Denker, Art, and Gingrich, which is the premier Greek lexicon of our day, which is considered to be the most scholarly New Testament Greek lexicon we have available to us, they define this word as a state of intense displeasure. Now, notice that. Intense displeasure, because we're going to see what the same lexicographer says about the second word, and we're going to notice the difference. This word is a state of intense displeasure, and it could rightly be translated, depending on the context, either anger or wrath or indignation or rage. And I put this one up here because you're not going to see this on the other words we're talking about. Wrath, rage. When you hear those words, what do you think of? That's some intense anger. That's anger peaking. This is the strongest form of anger that we have in the Bible insofar as the emotional state is concerned. This word's used of people. It's used of God. Of course, God can have it in a controlled sense because He doesn't have the problem with self-control that we do. It's even used of Satan. Revelation chapter 12, verse 12. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come to you having great thumos, having great wrath. Because he knows he has a short time. Now the second word is this word right here, arge. And by the way, we're going to try to have 25 minutes of discussion, but rather than having it in one chunk, I'm going to try to spread it out. So if at any point you have a comment you want to make, raise your hand, but I will be stopping periodically for us to discuss some of these things. The second word is arge. Now this one appeared 18 times in the New Testament. This one appears 36 times. In the New Testament. This is by far the most frequent. And similarly, and I don't know why the King James translators did this, this is almost always translated wrath. Well, so is this. 31 of the 36 times in the New Testament, it's translated wrath, although it's well known that it's not as intense a word as is this one. The same lexicographer that says this is intense displeasure speaks of this as relatively strong displeasure. and offers as synonyms anger and wrath, but never rage. Okay, so it's a little cooler form of anger. All right, I'm tempted to share some other stuff here, but I don't think I will. Well, I will go ahead and read to you one quote. If you're interested at all in the nuances of words, hear me out. If you're not, you can tune me out for the next 20 seconds. Mounce's complete expository dictionary of Old and New Testament words, a kind of a modern version of mine that may be a little more accurate. He says this: depending on the context, for arge is how this word's pronounced. Depending on the context, this term emphasizes either emotional anger or retributive wrath. That is, wrath that is directed at wrongdoing where there's going to be something done about it. In the former sense, the emotional sense, it can refer to a person who is angry, such as Jesus is in Mark chapter 3, verse 5. That's the word used of Jesus' anger in Mark 3, 5. More often, however, arge signifies God's indignation directed at wrongdoing. When God cut off a generation from entering the promised land, it was an oath He made, in Hebrews 3, 11, it was an oath He made in wrath, this kind of anger. In this anger, God decided the children of Israel were not going to the promised land. Hebrews 3:11, Hebrews 4:3. Paul equates God's wrath with His vengeance. This word Paul equates with God's vengeance in Romans 12:19. Let's read that together if you want to. Romans chapter 12, verse 19. It might help make sense of what I'm talking about here. Romans 12:19. Romans 12:19, beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. Now, what's that mean to give place? Let somebody else take care of it. Some translations, I think, say make room for. Okay, so don't avenge yourselves, but make room for wrath. Well, whose wrath? Yours? Well, obviously not, because you don't get to do the avenging. Make room for whose wrath? God's. Let's keep reading. Make room for wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. So when God executes vengeance on the ungodly, Paul says He will be doing so in arge. And so the word in the New Testament is used in this sense of exercising vengeance, but it's never applied that way to people. It's applied that way to God and one other entity. Anybody want to take a stab at it? No? Oh, that's a good guess. Government. Romans chapter 13, verses 4 and 5. The government gets to act in this as well when it comes to exercising vengeance. Because the government is God's minister for wrath. Romans chapter 13, verses 4 and 5. But insofar as this having to do with exercising, giving vengeance in wrath, it's never applied that way to people. Alright, so we've got thumos being this intense displeasure that can sometimes rightly be translated rage. We've got a lower key version that when applied to individuals has to do with just anger, focusing especially on the emotional side of it. Now, hang with me for just a moment longer as we contrast these. The third word, there's only a third word, and we're only going to talk about it for a moment. Let's compare and contrast these a little bit more. This word here and these two not only differ in intensity, but they differ in duration. Sometimes we see them together in the Bible. Four different times at least they're in a verse together. One example is Romans 2:8. We'll see thumos and arge together. Ephesians 4:31 is another one. One author points out that when you see them together, there's a distinction intended. Which one of the two would you expect to last longer? Yeah, it is the bottom one. It's the longer one. Because this one's the one that just flares up. This is the outburst of wrath. This is the word that is translated outbursts of wrath in 2 Corinthians 10:20 and then in Galatians 5:20. This one is a work of the flesh. This one is not. This one can be good. This is what Jesus had, and we'll get to that momentarily. But this one tends to be shorter in duration, although greater in passion. Thumos is never used positively concerning people. Never. With only one possible exception. And I'll let you make your comment if you have one. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 27, we are told that Moses left Egypt not fearing the wrath of the king. Now, what's that talking about? Why did Moses flee Egypt originally? What's that? Well, but not just because he'd killed the soldier. What was going to happen? Well, the Pharaoh found out. What was the Pharaoh going to do? Kill him. And the Pharaoh was going to do it, says the writer of Hebrews, in this. Not this, in this one. In this excited state of rage, he was going to kill Moses. So was he wanting to kill Moses just because he was trying to uphold the law? Or was he wanting to kill Moses for something else? It would appear something else. Maybe Moses was now asserting something and he viewed Moses as a rival. This guy was never really one of us anyway. Who's he think he is? But if we take that interpretation, then I can say with 100% certainty this word is never applied positively concerning individuals in the New Testament. Furthermore, this is the anger of mobs. Luke chapter 4, 28 and 29, after Jesus gets up Jesus gets up in the synagogue in Nazareth. He had been baptized. He had gone into the wilderness. Now he comes back to his hometown for the first time. He gets up and reads, as was his custom. These people were used to seeing Jesus read in the synagogue at Nazareth. He reads Isaiah 61, 1 and 2. He sits down, because that was the custom. You stood up to read. You sat down to comment. He sits down. They're waiting to hear what he says. And he tells them, I'm the fulfillment of this. And I know you won't believe me, because prophets are not accepted in their own country. Remember Elijah and Elisha? They went to people who were foreigners, or foreigners came to them because their own people wouldn't listen. And what did the people of Nazareth want to do to Jesus? Yeah. They took him to the brow of the hill on which their city was built. Luke chapter 4, verses 28 and 29. And they wanted to throw him off the cliff. And they says they were filled with this. Just rage. The anger of the mob. Same thing in Acts 19, when great is Diana of the Ephesians for 2 hours. When they heard this, they were filled of wrath and cried out, great is Diana of the Ephesians. So, I'm probably belaboring the point, but this is just not good. It's never called good. It's never called okay. It's never okay to have an outburst of wrath. It's never okay to blow your lid. That's what the Bible's telling us. This is the work of the flesh. It might make us feel powerful. It might make us feel like we really got our point across. But God says it's wrong. It's out of step with self-control. We'll get to this in a moment. Let's look at the last one. Make sure I've spelled that correctly. And I didn't. This should be an O. Greek words often have the emphasis on the very final syllable, so it's kind of awkward to our English tongues. Paragismos is how the word's pronounced. This word appears only one time in the New Testament. Ephesians 4:26. Can anyone quote Ephesians 4:26? It's probably the most famous passage on anger in the Bible. All right, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. That word, the wrath, is this word, which is very interesting. When Paul says, be angry, that's arge. It's the verb form of it. And he says, do not let the sun go down on this. Well, now what's that all about? Well, this word doesn't seem to appear in any non-biblical sources as far as I know. It seems to be referring to the state of being provoked. Not just being emotional, not just being angry, but being provoked, agitated, irritated. Maybe even bordering on, I don't want to overstate it. So, some of us have probably heard it taught, well, Ephesians 4:26 is saying, okay, it's okay to be angry, but you got to get it taken care of and get rid of your anger before the sun goes down. But is that what Paul's saying? I don't think so, because the two things are different meanings. He's saying, be angry. He doesn't put any time frame on it. Be angry. But do not remain in that condition of being provoked. Now, there are things that can happen where we can be legitimately angry and we can get provoked. Can't we? And it seems to me that Paul is saying there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but it needs to be dealt with quickly. Let me read to you a couple of quotes from men who know a lot more about this than I do. One of them is kind of old-fashioned and the other one's a lot easier. I'll do the old-fashioned one first. Paul is saying, be angry, yet in this anger of yours, allow no sinful element to mingle. There is that which may cleave even to righteous anger. This thing here, the irritation, the exasperation, it must be dismissed at once in order that being purged of this impurer element, the only thing that will remain is that which has a right to remain. Don't allow yourself to stay in that provoked, exasperated condition. Another author says, this word communicates the idea of provocation. If you have to be angry, if the cause is righteous, the provocation severe, then let the storm burst, but be sure the expression of your anger is not promiscuous or prolonged. Let calm follow the storm. Do not let the day end without quieting your spirit and making sure you have not grieved the Holy Spirit. And I like this last statement. You must not nurse your anger. I think our flesh likes being angry because it makes us feel powerful. There is a physical process that takes place when our body starts kicking out adrenaline, which then produces more glucose, which gives us this big burst of energy. And that's actually, there's a purpose for that. Anger is intended to destroy, but it's not to destroy people, it's to destroy problems. It serves a good purpose in its place. But it does give us a sense of a little something extra. And I think the flesh can latch onto that and want to hold on to it longer than we should. Okay, so summarizing all this, then we're going to move on. We have one kind of wrath that, if allowed to linger, is for sure sinful. This last one. I don't think do not let the sun go down in your wrath is intended literally necessarily. I mean, if you get to this point at 8:30 in the morning, the Bible's not saying, all right, well, hold on till it. You got a long summer day. You're up in Michigan. You're good till 10. No, it's get rid of this thing quickly. It should not linger. Chris, where's that mic?
Right in front of.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you, Dwight.
This may be me kind of summarizing that last one, the prognosis.
Sounds good.
Yeah. But to me, it seems like that type of anger is the type of anger where you're wanting to, let's say, do something to that person or something like that, where you're keeping that sort of anger with you to where it's not just like this outburst where you're actually wanting to do something to that other person. You have that vengeful nature in your heart. And so he doesn't want us to stay there because the longer we stay there, the more likely we are to act on it.
All right. Appreciate that.
That's
yeah. I think there's a lot of truth in what you just said. I don't think it's the only state of anger where we can be thinking about vengeance, but yeah, that one's more likely to lead us there. Doug, sorry.
To go along with your anger does things to us, I think another thing it does to us is it works to help convince us that we're right.
Yeah,
it reinforces, well, I'm right and the other person's wrong. And it gives us justification for being angry. And it's just like this circle that we can get caught up in.
Thank you. Okay.
Can you share Strong's numbers?
Yeah, just a moment. Strong's numbers.
3709.
Thank you. Okay, for the third one, the Paragus Moss is 3950. And like Neil just said, for Argay, it's 3709. And for Thumas, it's 2372. Those are the strong numbers. I think, Tim, you had a comment?
Do you think some men get a hankering taste for number three?
No question.
With respect to jealousy?
Proverbs does say that jealousy is a husband's fury. I don't know what the Hebrew for fury, where it would line up with these. But yeah, I think there are some people who almost perpetually live in that state of being provoked. They like being there. Life's boring if they're not there. I know people, and you've met them too, who they are always angry about something. I mean, they're just shaking and breathing hard. Oh, he did this at work, and you wouldn't believe what the guy did to me on the street. And it's just, they're just not happy unless they're there. Of course, they're not really happy being there.
That's how they control
people. Yes. Go ahead and put it. They're wanting to get it on the tape, if you would, Randy. Go ahead, Mike.
People use anger to control other people.
Absolutely.
And people that may not even think clearly, but they can use their anger to get the point across, even if the point is wrong.
Yes. That is so right. Physiologically what? Addicted to it. Oh, yeah? I think there is a release of endorphins, and I think you can get addicted to that. Yeah. You can get addicted to anything, just about.
Gordon? And this is a comment maybe for some clarification. So if my child disobeys me and provokes me, I got to get over that being provoked, but I still have to punish my child.
Mm-hmm.
And so the provoked is maybe the one that starts with the P, and I have to deal with it with the one with the O. Is that
this here? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're going to deal with this. It's the next thing up here. The Bible does have some. There's seven passages we're going to draw on to kind of tell us in what framework we can properly exercise this and so forth. This should be rare, but it should be in our lives as well. There's a time to be angry, and I don't know if God really puts any time frame on it. But why don't we just jump into that? I don't know why I'm speaking into this when I have a... Nobody had noticed, so I don't feel so bad. All right, let's take a look at our gay. Of the 36 appearances in the New Testament, only six of them concern individuals. And then we have a seventh where the verb form appears. That's Ephesians 4:26. And so we're going to incorporate that as well. So we got seven verses. What do we learn about our gay from these seven passages? Well, number one, I already mentioned it, Mark chapter 3, verse 5, Jesus experienced it. Now, before we read that passage, before we came here today, if you had been asked, was Jesus ever angry? I think most of us would have said yes. And if they had said, when was Jesus angry? What might you have said? I'm putting you in a bad place here, but what would you have said? All right, that's what we always say. We always say, well, he was angry when he drove him out of the temple. How do you know? It does not say so. We associate anger with the whip. Okay, that's yeah. I mean, what's the vision of the whip you've got?
The bull whip.
Okay, this big bull whip. Let's think about this for a minute. Number one, John chapter 2, verse 17 tells us what motivated him. His disciples were watching this, and then they remembered what the prophet had said. Then his disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house has eaten me up." Ardor, and ardor does not automatically equal anger. Not by any stretch. Oh, but John, but look what he's doing. He's overturning the tables of the money changers. He makes this whip. He's whipping people. He's whipping animals. This is a violent thing. He's obviously angry. Let's take a step back and think about this for a minute. I'm not going to say with absolute certainty that he wasn't, but I think we cannot prove that. Number one, John chapter 2, verse 15. If you want to turn there, it might be good to have it in front of you. Because our translations read differently on this, and depending upon how your translation reads, it will shape in partly how you view this. John chapter 2, verse 15, and by the way, he cleansed the temple at the beginning of his ministry, and he cleansed the temple again at the end of his ministry. They were served as bookends, which is interesting. John chapter 2, verse 15, when he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. Now that's New King James. The way that reads is he went and made this whip. How likely is it that it was a bull whip? Time constraints considered? Probably not. More likely, something not too terribly long enough to get the animals out. You don't really need a whip to get people out. Especially if you're the Son of God. I imagine there was something about his presence that made a person think twice. No one ever spoke like this man, the soldier said. Now, my translation says, in verse 15, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. Now, I'm benefiting from some things that Charles Fry posted on Facebook a couple weeks ago. Some of you might have seen it. Facebook can do good things. Number one, the word them is not in the Greek. And some of your translations will reflect that. So, he drove all out of the temple. Okay, that's no big deal. He drove all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. So that means he took that whip, he drove the people out, and he drove the animals out too. Except that the word with is not necessarily in the Greek. Some of your translations say and the people, or and the sheep and the oxen, and some of your translations say both the sheep and the oxen. In other words, let's take that. He made the whip. He drove all out of the temple, both the sheep and the oxen. If that's the proper rendering, which is what the ASV of 1901 says and what the NIV says, who did he drive out with the whip? The animals. He never touched the people at all. And furthermore, the people who were selling birds, what did he do? Well, if you look at it, verse 16, and he said to those who sold doves, take these things away, do not make my father's house a house of merchandise. It's probably hard to drive. I mean, if you try to drive a bunch of birds out, what are they likely to do? Well, they're likely to roost in the temple. So here they've got them caged, take them out. In other words, Jesus was interested in getting the animals out, it looks like, and he did what was necessary to get the animals out. There's no proof positive he ever used whatever this whip thing was on the people. The ones who had the doves, he just told them to leave. Well, he turned over the money he turned over the tables. Do you have to be in a rage to do something like that? Isn't it possible that the Son of God could walk over this and say, this has no place here, and just tip it over and be very cool and calm and collected? It absolutely is. Now, Mark chapter 11 details for us the second cleansing. We're given very little information, but it is interesting what we're given. It also kind of paints it in a different light. He enters Jerusalem. This is the day of the triumphal entry. He enters Jerusalem. He goes into the temple. Verse 11, Jesus went into Jerusalem and into the temple. So when he had looked around at all things, as the hour was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. That's a very interesting picture to me. He comes into the temple court. Day is getting late. He doesn't get the acclaim he should have gotten. But he kind of checks everything out. And then he goes back out of the city and spends the night in Bethany. He comes back in the next day. He's had all night to think about it, not that he needed it. He comes back into the city the next day, verse 15. So they came to Jerusalem. Then Jesus went into the... He'd seen the night before that the money changers were there again. They were selling animals there again. He came to Jerusalem. Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple, although we're not told how, and overturned the tables of the money changers and seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares to the temple. And then look at verse 17. Then he what? Taught, saying to them, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations? But you have made it a den of thieves. How have you envisioned him saying, you've made it a den of thieves? Well, if you watch it on the movie screen, he's probably shouting it. You've made it a den of thieves! But what's it say? He taught. I just want us to see here that, and you know, it's a little bit of a rabbit trail, but there's only one time in Jesus' whole life that we know for sure he got angry. Look at all that information we have about him, and only one time for sure the Bible says he was angry. That says something all by itself. Now, let's take a look at that one time. Mark chapter 3. Would someone read verses 1 through 5? Well, I guess I need to read it. Mark chapter 3, 1 through 5. Mark chapter 3, starting in verse 1. And he entered the synagogue again, and a man was there who had a withered hand. So they watched him closely, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, step forward. Then he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil? To save life or to kill? Now the answer to that's obvious. If they had an ox in the ditch on the Sabbath, what did they do? They got it out. They thought, you know, it's, even though the law, you're not supposed to work, you can save an animal. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. So he asked him a question. What about people? Verse 4. But they kept silent. And when he had looked around at them with anger, argay, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts, He said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched out and his hand was restored as whole as the other. Why was Jesus angry? The hardness of their heart. Yeah, there was probably some knowledge. What were they thinking before he even did the miracle? What does it say they were hoping to accomplish in verse 2? Yeah. Here's the man who is performing a miracle that could only be done by the power of God. So obviously God is with him. Obviously that what he is doing is okay. But instead of seeing the obvious, they're waiting to see if he'll perform a miracle on the Sabbath day that they can foolishly call work and then have something of which supposedly to accuse him. Their heart is everywhere but where it's supposed to be. And then he asks them a completely fair, logical question to which the answer is obvious. They won't answer it because, of course, that won't let them do what they want. And then once he does the right thing, they go out. And in verse 6, what's it say? They went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians against him how they might destroy him. Now, he wasn't only angry, though. What else was he? Grieved. I'll just give you the verses. But there are two other times in the Bible where grief is juxtaposed right with anger like this. Genesis 34:7, when Jacob's sons find out how Dinah's been defiled, it says the men were grieved and very angry. Genesis 45:5, when Joseph reveals himself to his brothers, he says, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. I just thought that was interesting. We could probably talk a whole bunch of possible psychological stuff related to that, but there's an interesting connection there apparently. Grief and anger have some connection, and I think with depression and other things we can see that. Now, Jesus' anger was justified. It was not selfish, though. It had a specific purpose. There was sin, and this angered him. Now, is he serving as an example for us in that regard? I think so. 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse 6. I don't know how familiar you are with this story, and the only reason I'm saying it is one of those chapters in 1 Samuel that I wouldn't have remembered unless you rehearsed it to me. Nahash the Ammonite has come to the city of Gibeah. And he's told the people of Gibeah send out an ambassador, and they say, okay, we'll be your servants. Make a treaty with us. And Nahash says, okay, yeah, I'll make a treaty with you on this condition. I get to gouge out the right eye of everybody in the city. Okay, so the Gibeonites or the people of Gibeah say, well, give us 7 days. They send word to Israel and Saul gets word of it. 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse 6 is when Saul finds out about this horrible thing that Nahash is wanting to do. 1 Samuel chapter 11, let's back up in verse 5. It tells us, by the way, something very interesting about the early monarchy of Israel. When you think of a king, you think of him sitting in his royal robes in a palace and all that. But this is very early on. Now, there was Saul coming behind the herd from the field. And Saul said, what troubles the people that they weep? And they told him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then, verse 6 is why we're here. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard these words, and his what? Anger was greatly aroused. Now, when the Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson, what did he do? Incredible feats of strength. When the Spirit of the Lord came upon one of the judges, because it's throughout the book of Judges, they were able to accomplish amazing things. It seems like the Spirit of God would strengthen them, maybe increase their stamina, a number of things. And that may be all that the Spirit is doing here for Saul. Yet, it says the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, and the very next thing we're told is what? His anger is greatly aroused. What does the Spirit do for you? The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace. These are all conditions of the mind, states of mind. And we are being told that the Spirit is responsible in part for their presence in your life. Could it be? Could it be that the Holy Spirit wanted Saul to be angry? That the same Spirit who works in you, augmenting your holy feelings, it's God who works in you both to will, that is to desire. God's at work in your desires. Philippians 2:13. That same Spirit augmented Saul's anger? I think it's possible in light of the reading. And it's appropriate because what was going on in Gibeah? Monstrous sin. These men, Nahash, wanted to cripple these people for life. And his reason was he wanted to bring dishonor on Israel. It was spite. That's something to be angry about. Anger is the very strongest emotion that we have. I read that a number of times. I'd never really thought about it that way, but it's true. You think, well, we have emotions that get pretty strong. Love is strong as death, so you can't really argue anger stronger than that in that sense. But when it comes to just full expression, anger is awfully powerful. Anger energizes, it injects us with that extra something, and Saul was going to need it to get the job done. Anger was appropriate. Ephesians 4:26, be angry and do not sin. Notice, not if you get angry, when you get angry, but be angry. What's that sound like? Well, what are you thinking, John? Don't tell me what I'm thinking. Tell me what I'm thinking, but I'm interested in knowing what you're thinking too. What does be angry sound like? It sounds like a command, doesn't it? Be angry.
Or also almost an allowance for that feeling.
All right. And those are the two different positions. Some take the position, well, this is just Paul allowing it. Others take the position that it is a command. In my opinion, which isn't worth much, it's just my opinion, but since I'm up here, I'm giving my opinion. It sounds to me like an imperative. The Lord is saying, do this. There are times when you should be angry. Somebody once said that anger can be kindled by the fire of hell or by the fire from the altar of God. Jesus was angry at these men's sin. Saul was angry at these men's sin. And somebody said, the person who cannot get angry, for example, at the seduction of an innocent girl, at the corrupting of a child, at those who practice and propagate perversion, any number of the monstrous sins that are in this world, if you can't get angry at that, you either are spineless or wholly without moral conviction. And I agree with that. When I see, I don't think I was wrong in this, when I see innocent people lined up on a beach, and I never watched it, I saw the still frame. When I see innocent people lined up on the beach and butchers behind them getting ready to cut their heads off to make a point in the name of their God, it makes me angry. What a horrible injustice. I don't think God's okay with it. I'm not okay with it. Now I need to keep that anger right here and not let it go anywhere else. And probably it doesn't need to linger long at all. But I think it has its place. Anger over personal insult, over personal injury, my feelings got hurt, or because I didn't get what I want when the person had done nothing wrong, this is wrong. But anger that is divorced from my pride, anger that's divorced from my selfishness, that's aroused by genuine injustice, real wrongdoing, in other words, sin, this has a place in our lives, brethren. It has a place in our lives. And notice, if you will, for just a moment, in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, the strong language that Paul uses concerning the sin the congregation had in the camp. They had a man among them who was sleeping with his father's wife, such evil as is not even named among the Gentiles, he says in the 1 Corinthian letter. And he says, you responded as you should, 2 Corinthians 7:11, for observe this very thing, that you sorrowed in a godly manner. What diligence it produced in you. What clearing of yourselves. What indignation. What fear. What vehement desire. What zeal. What vindication. In all these things you proved yourselves to be clear in this matter. We're not talking about blowing up. We're not talking about clamming up and letting it boil there and becoming a pressure cooker. We're just talking about genuine displeasure that moves us to action. This is wrong. It's not right. I'm not okay with this. And this feeling I'm getting right now is my gift from God to take godly action about the problem. That can be applied in marriage. That can be applied in child rearing. It should be applied in the church. I'll stop there for any comments or questions. We'll hit Michael here, and then we'll pass it back to Tim.
And maybe you'll get to this at some point. I was just thinking, do we have any indications in the Bible as to... And you touched on it a little bit earlier, the indications we see where Jesus and different people got angry. It was about God being... Or sin being... actions being taken against God.
Yes,
and His house.
Yes.
And they never really were self-centered.
Absolutely.
And I just was trying to think, when we talk about all these different things, where do we draw the line at where our anger, how angry should we get about someone maybe not being as responsible as they should be in their life, or maybe not being as caring? Those are things to maybe be frustrated about too, but do we go to the point of getting angry about it? Are we justified to get to that point?
I am going to address that, but not probably as exhaustively as it could be. Tim, you had a comment, and I'll come back to Jane. When we get there, though, I'll let you know so we can talk about
that. Can you say anything about how this differs from empathy? Is that a word we can use in this context, or is it...
Anger being this, somewhat synonymous or parallel to empathy?
Where it says, with diligence it is produced in you, indignation is... when we empathize with someone, does that differ from this type of anger that was ignited in Saul?
Well...
Well, I'm thinking about it. Is, in the law of this country is that if someone stands and watches, you stand and watch somebody else be victimized, that's against the law. You're supposed to do something.
Oh, I see the connection now. Thank you. I don't have any comment to make on that, but it's an interesting thought. I'm thinking of that anger grief thing we were talking about a moment ago.
All right, I have two comments. One is to go back to what Doug said earlier, that, you know, as men, we never have problems, but we always want to fix yours. To what you said earlier on about how men were always the ones that were angry and women were not in the scripture. I think that's, my wife and I have discussed this before, and I think it's because women internalize things. If you do something and it would make a man angry because we don't do anything wrong, or, you know, I don't have a problem, it's your problem, we get angry. A woman internalizes that and feels as though she did something wrong.
Yes.
That's what I think anyway. So women internalize it and men would rather push the blame on somebody else. But also,
I agree with that.
I have a question, I guess it would be. In James 1:20, it says, the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. And
Thank
that's
you.
That orge.
It is, it is.
The 3709.
Yes. So that was my very next point. I'll try to make this as quick as we can because I know we're starting to run out of time. Jesus had orge. We are told to have it in Ephesians 4:26. And yet, we are to be slow to it. It says there in James 1:19, be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to orge. All right. So you can get there, but you need to get there slowly. Don't be in a hurry. That's how God works, and you need to work the same way. And keep in mind also that generally speaking, the overwhelming majority of the time, what does orge do? Well, it does not produce the righteousness of God. Generally, we use it to control people, to insult people, to exercise our pride on people. It has a place, but it's a small place. And when you get there, not only make sure you got there for the right reasons, but make sure you express it rightly. And don't get there very often because you tend not to, is what I understand him to be saying there. I guess, are we supposed to be done right now? Okay. All right. I didn't do a very good job with that. I do have some handouts, I guess, but I can... I'm doing it again. I guess if you take one and just kind of pass them around if you would. This is called the Heart Journal. I got it from a book called The Heart of Anger. I wouldn't necessarily recommend the book, although it does have some good things in it. It's primarily about how to help your children if they're having anger. And generally, if your children have anger, you've got it too. So it's got a lot of good things in it. But once you see it, you will notice if you get angry, if you've got a problem with anger, and you probably know if you do, Proverbs 14:10, the heart knows its own bitterness. If you've got a problem with anger, you know it. This will help. Now, I say that as not having, I don't think I've ever used this myself, but going through it carefully, I can see how it would help. And I have a testimony of a Christian who shared with me that this helped this individual a great deal. The first question, after you've had some trouble with anger. Maybe you're still even kind of in the moment. Lock yourself up in your office or the den or whatever and force yourself to think it through. This first question is just very straightforward. I don't know why this second question is in parentheses. It doesn't really make any sense to me. It looks pretty much like the same question. But in questions 2, 3, and 4, the question in normal type has to do with what you were thinking in your heart, the thought of the heart, and the second question has to do with the intent or the motives of the heart. And those are two different things because we don't always tell ourselves the truth, do we? We tell ourselves, oh, I'm, you know, this is okay and I'm doing this. When we really stop and start soul searching, we realize, oh, that's not really why I was doing it. And the point of this is to identify what's really going on in your heart and mind, and then in questions 3 and 4, put it in the light of Scripture. Mummify it, like Doug was saying. And I can see, even though I must admit I have no personal experience with it, just walking through it this morning, I thought I could see where this would do a lot of good. And one final comment. When it says down here in the bottom, the parenthetical on number 4, what should I have wanted more than my own selfish and idolatrous desires? Desire can be tricky because we may find that the thing we got angry about was not inherently a wrong desire. It was a legitimate desire, desired too much. You know, it's okay to desire food, but you can desire food too much. It's okay to desire acceptance, but you can desire it too much. It's okay to desire a number of things, and sometimes that can be at the heart of our problem. Where God, instead of God playing focus, He's kind of gone over here to the periphery, and my focus is now this other thing. So, I appreciate your attention, and you've got a break, and I'll let Jeremy determine how long that will be. Thanks.